Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome, welcome, welcome to episode number 27 of Real Blend, a podcast that desperately needs a new name for Kevin McCarthy's beard. So, please send your best suggestions via email to realblend.
Hashtag beardblend.
We'll send them via email to realblend@cinemablend.com if you want to use email, or head over to our Twitter account, which is @realblend. And come up with your best beard nickname, and you can use hashtag beardblend if you want to.
Harry in the Hendersons, but Harry spelled H-A-I-R-Y.
I like that one.
I like Dirty Harry with a good
H-A-R-Y. Dirty Harry is a really good one. Yeah.
And then someone said Harry Styles, but like H-A-I-R-Y, and then like, but like you spell Styles like with a Z.
Wait, he was in Dunkirk, wasn't he?
He was in Dunkirk. See, I'm telling you, this. I always try to bring it back to Dunkirk somehow
every single time,
and it works sometimes. I'm getting a beard trim right after the show today. I'm very excited about it.
I love it. My name is Sean O'Connell, Managing Director at Cinema Blend. I am joined, as always, by my amazing friends and colleagues, starting with Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago.
Hello, you handsome bastard. How are you?
I'm great, Jake. How are you?
Damn good to see you.
Good. And the beard transporter himself, Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, just for the record, I also am attempting to grow.
Well, and truthfully, compared to what I can do, which is nothing, that's really good. So, we said it a few weeks back that if we got reviews on our iTunes page, we were going to read them on the show, and that worked a lot better than we anticipated because we have 4 brand new reviews. I mean, this reaction to our iTunes page was staggering, and in 4, you know, in a week might not seem like a lot to you guys, but for a brand new show like us, that was really, really cool. So, I'm going to read 2 of them, because other than that, I just feel like I'm just like we're tooting our own horn a little bit too much. So
screen,
I want to
screen names away, dude. The screen names for these reviews are Jake's mom 65,
right,
and Jake's mom 35.
She's very busy.
Yeah,
very busy. Got a lot going on. She's actually the one that's going to be trimming Kevin's beard later.
Yeah.
She's a team player all around.
Jan's right over here right now. Hey,
so
Jan.
I would like to thank Uncanny Comic Quest, who actually floated us a very cool Wonder Woman 1984 theory that we're probably going to use for a segment
of
the show.
Oh, that's cool. I did read that. That was really interesting.
I like that. I thought that was very clever. And then someone named Nash13 Fan wrote a long and really cool review that made all of us blush and feel very, very proud. But Indigo15 follows us on Twitter and wrote in one of our iTunes reviews. He said, "I've enjoyed watching Jake on Fox 32 in Chicago for years now." So go ahead, Jake. Take a bow.
That's
very
me.
Nice. And I discovered Kevin and Sean and this podcast through him. Not only are all 3 guys expert film reviewers and extremely knowledgeable, but they are also funny, likable, and have an intense passion for film that you can feel in their discussions. Unlike a lot of critics out there, they never get nasty or mean-spirited with their criticisms. Only in the text chain.
Yeah. Wait until we have our Jurassic World conversation.
Oh,
today.
That could get a little bit heated. And
respect could get nasty and mean-spirited.
For the actors and directors whose work they discuss, even when they don't particularly care for something, which makes the podcast all the more enjoyable. So he ends with "Great work, guys," which I think is really very nice.
Who's that?
Awesome.
That is Indigo15.
Indigo15, thank you.
That's his or her actual legal name.
I think so. 15. He's the 15th child of
15th
Mr.
and
Mrs. Indigo.
The 15th Indigo.
Yes.
Right.
And then also, so brace for this one. This is Maverick 347.
Wow.
As in, there were 346 other Mavericks.
Yes.
Right. That's what we're saying. They have to use their legal name when they comment. Right?
They sat there and typed the name in until they found 347 of them.
Did you guys not see the South Park episode about Apple's policies? That's in there. You have to use your legal, real name. So Maverick 347 is the person's real name.
Well, they said
Big Daddy Kevin.
This is worth subscribing to right away. They said, "This is an amazing movie podcast. Each guy has unique and well thought out views over the topics discussed. I love listening to this podcast each week. They are also great at connecting with fans via social media, which we like to do try a lot. As an As an aspiring film journalist, Real Blend has been helpful in showing me how to be a good journalist and overall film watcher. How great is
that? That's awesome. That's really cool.
That's very cool.
Isn't that cool?
Thank you for listening. We appreciate, especially with all that negativity out there, it's nice that we're getting nice comments. So thank you for listening.
It takes a lot more effort, apparently, these days to be nice than it does to be a douche. So I appreciate the effort.
Good. Let's keep this place a podcast for positivity. Starting with news. Jake, what's our news theme song?
It's time for the news.
Starting with Spider-Man.
Was that planned?
No, not at all.
Oh, okay.
No, wow. Totally off the cuff.
Appreciate you think that was pre-planned.
That was incredible.
Thanks. Spider-Man sequel has a title. It will be called Spider-Man Far From Home. And we learned from Kevin Feige when we interviewed him at the Ant-Man Junket that title obviously has a lot of different meanings. What do you guys think of the subtitle? Does it get you excited, or you're going to go see it because it's Spider-Man no matter what?
I liked Homecoming a lot. I find that, I don't know if I necessarily in my mind at the moment am like feeling that I need another Spider-Man film, but I love Tom Holland so much. But I will say this, I like Tom Holland as Spider-Man in other films more than I like Spider-Man movies alone. I think that Tom Holland interacts so well with the Avengers. And obviously the best scenes in Homecoming besides the Michael Keaton limo scene are with Robert Downey Jr. So I don't know, but I'm still fascinated by how Kevin Feige is going to promote this film.
Right.
I believe if I have it right that Avengers 4 hits theaters in May and then this movie hits theaters in July.
Correct.
Of next year. So if you're Sony, think about when a trailer is normally released for a movie, like teaser-wise, what, about 6 to 4 months out, possibly?
Well, so I looked back and checked on the last Homecoming, Spider-Man Homecoming, which came out around the same time in that same slot, had a December trailer, and then they had a longer Super Bowl spot.
Well, I guess all they really need to do is do a teaser for now.
Right.
They probably will mess around with the Thanos element, I would imagine. That there were probably enough people saw that. I guess the question there is Disney and Sony, they're two different studios, both within the same Marvel Cinematic Universe somehow, which is still very weird to me. So I don't know how they're going to play with that. I have no idea.
Unless the Far From Home means some sort of alternate reality, which Spider-Man is still in.
Is it possible this is before the snap? This is phase 4, so how it can't be, right?
It's possible, but Feige has said that the Spider-Man sequel would be the first movie to address the Marvel Cinematic Universe after the events of Avengers 4. He's said that. But now he's basically said, don't assume just because we've announced Spider-Man Far From Home and a Guardians of the Galaxy 3 that those necessarily mean that they're in a phase. He's the king of misdirection. He's the master of three-card Monty. And whatever I'm showing you, I'm not really showing you. So, who knows? Who knows?
And that's the deal. Like, that's why I always sort of don't get super into speculating what Marvel is going to do. Because they're very meticulous about how they give out information. Like, the whole thing about Tom Holland accidentally revealing the title. Like, I don't buy that. Like, that was
completely, that was staged.
That was so staged.
But that makes me upset that it's staged. Because now they're now aware that Tom Holland's like this... The whole bit with him now is
the whole
him
bit
and
with the accident. Yeah, but you know, and that's
do the
like,
bit.
You know, and I feel like a majority of people realize it was staged, but then I did see some people reporting it's like Tom Holland accidentally leaks the time. I'm like, no, like, come on, like, you know, Kevin Feige is right off camera like a blow dart, ready to take this kid down. Like, and honestly, like the title, I think the title's cool. And if we're gonna keep like if Home is gonna be in the title of all of the trilogy, I think that could be cool. I honestly thought the next one was gonna be called Prom.
Yeah,
but. That did not work out in favor.
I keep thinking about that Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman movie when I hear that title for some reason. What's that movie called?
Eyes Wide Shut.
Far and Away.
Far and Away. I don't know why.
Oh, in a completely different direction.
Kevin's always thinking about Eyes Wide Shut. my disappointment is just, like, to me, the era of Spider-Man's my guy. I've said that before in the podcast. I love that hero. And the Homecoming thing was like, he's not quite in Manhattan yet. Like, he's not. He's still, like, Queens and... So I was actually pretty excited that those scenes in Infinity War are the first time that we've seen MCU Spider-Man like fighting in Central Park, right? So yeah. I was like, oh, good, he's going to finally go to New York. And they're like, no, we're going to Europe. Oh. And I was like, oh, yep. I don't really need
wait,
to see him in Europe.
This one is definitely in Europe. That's the definite case.
Feige said that he's probably on summer trip with his classmates, and they are shooting in London. So I think that some of it's going to take place in London.
Who's directing the second one?
John Watts is coming back for it. So, in news that I'm not sure any of us really want, Indiana Jones 5 seems to be taking a step forward with Jonathan Kasdan writing the script, coming off of Solo.
Please, God, tell me where he got the name Jones from.
Oh,
tell me it's because he was jonesing for something.
No,
tell me
from
he
the
really
dog.
Wanted.
Here's what's going to happen. Here's what's going to happen.
Jones.
No. His name
Please,
is,
God, give me this.
His name is Jones. And what's going to happen is he's going to be like with his like he's going to be in college or whatever. Right. And then we're going to flash back to him in college and he's going to be dating a girl and she's going to be from Indiana.
Right.
And then they're going to go to Indiana to meet her parents. And then they're going to legally change his name to Indiana Jones.
Dude, isn't there a scene in Deadpool where like he gets the name Deadpool from something that's written on a
They make
chalkboard?
Fun of scenes like that. Yeah. He literally they make a song about how terrible that idea is. It's right. called Captain Deadpool. And it's this whole song about coming up with a name based on a scene like that. Also,
I think
Deadpool,
that's just a Snatch reference.
Yeah, yeah. Well, then
someone's
going to
say, wait, someone's going to say Indiana. I can't say that the whole time. We'll just call you Indy.
Oh, my God. Honestly, that's going to happen. You guys do realize that. This guy who wrote
and
this...
I will be okay with it.
No, you're not going to be okay with it because it's a horrible idea. And I think, yeah, if that happens with the Indiana and Indy thing, I'm going to scream. Like, it's good. Like, that was... I don't understand why they're hiring this guy. I mean, listen, I think Kasdan...
Oh, my God, you sound like a Star Wars fan.
No, Lawrence Kasdan is a great writer, and he's written some great Star Wars films. But when he brought in John, Solo was a bad script. It's a horrible script. And I don't know why John is writing. I don't get it. I don't understand it.
How is that a horrible
It's a bad script.
Okay, wait. But that's not what concerns me. Harrison Ford is 75 years old. Like, by the time he starts to shoot it. And he looks great. I'm not saying he doesn't look great. But, like, aren't we get to a point where it's too old to do this? Don't we have to sort of stop? And if Spielberg only has X amount of movies left... Should one of them be Indiana Jones 5?
Here's what I'll say. I'm intrigued by the idea of a Lucas-less Indiana Jones.
Okay.
His fingerprints were all over Crystal Skull.
Yeah, but the first three were Lucas-filled.
Yeah, but from what I read, Spielberg didn't want to do the alien plotline in Crystal Skull. But Lucas had final say over the story and said, you know, like, I'm not going to sign off on it unless we do this story. And I think Spielberg begrudgingly... I think Spielberg probably hates Crystal Skull as much as we do.
I don't know.
So,
but
he hates it. It's his movie. But like, yeah, I get what you mean. He probably didn't want it to go that way.
Yeah, but so I say give Spielberg a shot to close out Indy on his own terms.
Okay. Let's talk about the first image from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yes.
I mean, it looks badass, but did it tell us anything? Or besides the fact that
they're very handsome.
They just started shooting, so I mean, I don't, they're in production, correct?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, like, I mean, you know, it was kind of a cool little, just like, you know, we had nothing.
I thought it was big. I took it as, like, they're about to start filming. They're filming outside in Hollywood. There's going to be paparazzi everywhere.
Yeah.
Let's control how the image gets out. Rather than paparazzi image leak out, let's take an official image, put it everywhere, and now the paparazzi photos are worthless.
And then that guy Matt Prince from Taco Bell PR tweeted me that there's going to be a Taco Bell in the movie. But if you go to IMDb, there's already a Taco Bell shot on the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood page. I don't know how that got there, if somebody added that in, but there is an actual old school 60s Taco Bell already like up there somewhere.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. When did Taco Bell start? Was Taco Bell around that time?
It had to have been if it's involved in the film. I don't know when John Bell started it, but I do know.
The guy's name is John Bell.
I'm almost certain it's John Bell.
And you like tacos? So we're going to call
like
it
Taco Bell.
Yeah. Thank you, Jonathan Kasdan.
And that doesn't bother you at all?
No, because it wasn't a 40-year franchise Where they with it, where they then said 40 years later, you're yeah. by yourself.
I rest my case.
You're solo.
Sean Bell likes tacos.
I'm done. I'm done with this argument.
It's completely different than what you're referring to. It's completely different. It's completely different.
When John Jacob Fillet decided he liked chicks.
John Bell, that was already part of Taco Bell's story when it first started. The Han Solo part came in after 7 films. They said, let's figure out how to say his name.
Kevin.
He's by himself. That's
tell
dumb.
Us.
I'm
tell
sorry.
Us about the single track.
No, it's
shot.
Glenn. It's Glenn Bell, not John Bell. Glenn
You're not
Bell.
Helping your case at all.
It's Glenn Bell. Sorry. Glenn Bell.
It's not the first name that I'm focused on.
Because when I went to visit the headquarters, they were on Glenn Bell Way. So I assume that's the guy I'm thinking about. It's Glenn Bell. Not John
Bell. We went to Lake Tahoe to see the presentation for the upcoming Drew Goddard film, Bad Times at the El Royale.
Oh, my God.
Eric Eisenberg wrote some stuff for Cinema Blend, and Kevin was one of the ones who got to go also. So now we're going to tap him for his knowledge of this amazingly beautiful single tracking shot that he does.
Okay.
Can you tell us a bit about it? Can you talk about it?
Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's honestly Children of Men level good. I mean,
when you
even
said that blew my mind.
So this is one
How
of...
How could it be that good?
Because of what... So here's the thing. Children of Men level, what I mean by that is the what went into it. So for example...
Okay.
The actual one shot that we all know about from Children of Men, I think there's two that people talk about. The one I always think about is the SUV sequence with the ping pong balls.
Yeah,
and then But most people actually talk about the walk out. I think it's an infinite shot.
That one's incredible.
Yeah.
But so I want to say in Children of Men that one or both of them are stitched somehow. I don't think that the car one is stitched, but I believe the walking one is stitched. What that means is they like combine the shots. But this shot that Drew Goddard did is, it's honestly something I've never seen before. It's simultaneously one of the most incredibly beautiful things I've ever seen, but also it's an interesting way to tell the story because it actually works. It's not just a cool shot for cool shot's sake. It's like Drew Goddard was saying, it's more along the lines of, we need to have John Hamm walk down this hallway. So people who don't know, Bad Times at El Royale is essentially 7 strangers kind of check into this hotel, this rundown hotel, and it's about redemption. Some really shady stuff is happening. So John Hamm's character, as we meet in the footage, he shows up and he finds this back door area, essentially, where he can walk behind the rooms and peer into each room as he passes. So on the other side of the room, they're looking into a mirror. Remember in Cabin of the Woods when scene, mm-hmm. when they first get there and that girl's changing and the guy can see her through the window, and then he goes in to tell her. So it's very similar to that. It's very similar, and Drew Goddard obviously directed both of those. But you're walking down each room hallway, and it's one continuous shot. It took 27 takes, 8 months of preparation. And the fascinating part about the shot is the reflections. So John Hamm is reflected against the mirror. How do you keep the camera out of the shot? And that to me was just, I've never seen anything like it. I don't know how, he explained it to me and I still don't know how he did it. And it's an interesting, it's a beautiful storytelling perspective because the whole concept is that you, like John Hamm, are walking through this hallway and you are experiencing the unnerving anxiety as to what he's experiencing. So in the shot we saw, as he passes each room, we peer into one room, we see Jeff Bridges. He's doing something very weird. Then we get to the next room. We see Cynthia Erivo. She's singing for some reason. We don't know why, but it's very weird. Then we get to Dakota Johnson, and she's doing something even stranger. And as the shot progresses, he goes up and down the hallway, back and forth, while Cynthia Erivo is singing live. And as I just said, Sean, while you were away, 27 takes and 8 months of preparation. And the way they did the reflections, which is kind of cool. So if you look in the trailer, you can see the shot, part of it. You see John Hamm reflected against a window while he's looking into somebody's room. The question there being, how the heck did they remove the reflection of the camera from the window? How did they
do
that?
Did you guys ever see how they did it in The Matrix? Remember that shot in The Matrix when they're shooting the doorknob?
The doorknob.
With Keanu's hand? And that they had to decorate the camera to look like more like Morpheus. Like
yep. Yeah, that's awesome.
I think that's hilarious.
Yeah,
very
but
clever.
Here, apparently, they had the windows on a swivel, and you could slightly turn them so that the reflection stayed on him, but took the camera out.
That's
so
awesome.
There's no digital effects except for apparently the back behind it, but there's a track that John Hamm had to maneuver around, stepping over. So if you saw Children of Men, the car scene with the ping pong ball, the actors actually had to duck down from the camera. So there's to think about the orchestration of that moment, even with John Hamm, staying in character, one, everyone had to be completely silent while Cynthia Erivo sung live. So Jeff Bridges is in the room doing what he's doing. When we leave his room and come back to him later on, he's doing something different. All that had to happen while completely silent.
That's amazing.
Like, people had to come in and maneuver him in a way for him to move and do things so Cynthia's song didn't get drowned out by sounds. So it's very elaborate, very interesting.
That's
on
cool.
top of that, technicality aside, it's a very interesting storytelling piece. And it could have easily been stitched. All they had to do is stitch it in between the walls.
Right.
And he decided not to, because it actually makes it flow better and it's more immersive as the audience member.
That's
and
right.
you are feeling the anxiety and the unnervingness that Ham's feeling. So very, very cool stuff. And I rewatched Cabin in the Woods two nights ago, and that movie's just a masterpiece.
That's a hell of a movie.
So I think Bad Times at the El Royale is going to be a big film for us to all talk about once it finally hits. I still don't know what it's about. I still don't know a lot about what's going on. I just know what I saw was amazing.
Drew Goddard is going to go on and do X-Force afterwards, too. So
is
he's going to get to play with Deadpool and Cable.
Yeah.
Is it horrible that, like, with a director like that, I don't want them going on and taking on a big franchise? Like,
I love
the stuff like El Royale, and I love the Cabin in the Woods. I would be totally cool. Like, whenever I hear, like, oh, this director is going to do in a big franchise, because I mean, I feel like you can only bring so much of yourself to a franchise as opposed to like something like El Royale, or because he's got so many people he has to answer to with a big franchise with $100 million, $200 million. But when you're dealing with a smaller budget, he can do whatever he wants. And I'd rather a movie where he can do whatever he wants.
He told me he has final cut on El Royale, which is a very rare thing.
I buy that, though.
Unless you're Steven Spielberg. But here's the cool thing about what Drew Goddard did. He wrote the script on spec. And he went to the studio and said, here's what I want to do. I want this song, this song, this song, this song. I want to shoot on 35mm. If you want to buy this, this is how we're doing it. And they said, okay.
That's amazing.
And then that's the movie he made.
I mean,
so it's like
Cabin in the Woods is like all the calling card you need, I would imagine.
And Cabin in the Woods sat on the shelf for 3 years.
I know, it's unbelievable.
And like, I asked him when we got up after our interview, I said, did that make you mad? And he said, and did you want to go back and change anything? No, the cut that went on the shelf 3 years before we released it was the cut you saw.
Awesome.
There was nothing.
I'm glad they probably didn't try to, because in that time,
special
Hemsworth
effects.
Got Thor. I was gonna say Hemsworth became Thor. I'm amazed that the studio wasn't like, oh, we hit a jackpot. Let's cut this so that there's more Hemsworth in it.
And what's brilliant about his character, and if people who've seen Cabin in the Woods, is the way the air quality in the cabin makes them think. And I love that line when like he's becoming very jockish, like he's becoming, and he's not that way.
Well,
and
that's what's brilliant about that.
Right.
Is that, like, it takes those cliche horror movie roles and makes fun of them because he was like very smart,
a sociology major.
Yeah.
The guy even says, like, what's going on with him? He why is he being a quote unquote dumb jock?
Yeah.
Hey, he's like the sociology major. So that movie, oh my god! I mean,
I'd argue, like, I never really think of it as an apocalypse movie, but it's one of the best like apocalyptic movies ever. I just never think of it as, I mean, if you think it's, spoiler alert, it's a movie about the end of the world.
And Drew Goddard's story is so cool, and I know we gotta move on, but real quick, he grew up in New Mexico, he was telling me, and I guess he just drove to Hollywood, and he called every studio while he was there and said, I will do anything I can possibly do on your sets if you let me.
Wow.
And so he goes, but I was always this excited guy. I never was jaded, so everyone around me was kind of drawn, like not drawn to me, but like they liked the fact that I was excited to just drive scripts around until 3 a.m. to different writers. And that's how he got connected with Joss Whedon. Whedon then brought him on to Buffy, and then the rest is history.
So we're at the Critics' Choice Awards, and the year that Cabin in the Woods was nominated for like Best Horror Film, we have the category there, and it was after the show that I walked up to Joss, and Joss was like, I forget the timing of it. Did he do Avengers and was about to do Age of Ultron? I forget which one it was. But I walked up and I was like, dude, I just want to talk to you about Cabin in the Woods. And like his guard dropped because I think he thought he was going to get like Marvel questions.
Yeah.
So we just shot the breeze about Cabin in the Woods for a bit. And then I'm like, who is this towering dude next to me? And I turned and I'm like, oh, dear God, it's Drew Goddard. Like,
yeah. I thought you were going to say it was Kevin.
Yeah, well, Kevin was also there. Kevin and Lauren were like right there with me. And then you guys ended up dancing with them. I remember.
Yeah, we had danced with Joss Whedon, which was so crazy.
I was there for that.
You were there for that one?
I also danced with Joss Whedon.
Yes.
Nice. Because we have a picture. Was that the year
we
that
do, yeah. For our audience, though, if you haven't seen Cabin in the Woods, which I'm sure a lot of people have that are listening to our podcast, I highly recommend it. But Bad Times of the El Royale, just keep that on your radar. And it wasn't on my radar whatsoever until I saw that footage. I didn't know anything about it. And I was like so...
Also, can we say how weird our lives are that we could be like, oh yes, I too was dancing with Joss Whedon.
What are our
lives? So that's something that comes out of our... I texted someone the other day, like, oh, like, you know, sorry, I can't be at this event. I got to be in Paris on that date for Tom Cruise. And so she replied back, who texts things like that? Like, this is our life.
Yeah, Jake always tells a great story about having, taking off for his job, and he put on the request sheet, I'm interviewing Tom Cruise. I have to take off today. And then the guy...
I was a waiter, and I got
fired.
And it
was the truth. And the guy didn't believe. Did he fire you?
Yeah, he fired me.
Yeah. It's so weird.
That's great. I want to use Jake's transition from directors who shouldn't move on to blockbuster projects because we love what they're doing in the independent realm to talk about J.A. Bayona's Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, which had a huge opening and, in my opinion, had no trace of Bayona in it at all. So
I disagree with that.
Disagree 100%.
Well, let's get into it.
Oh my God.
This is a spoiler-filled...
disagree with you more on that than your thoughts on Forrest Gump. That's crazy. Like, the Bayona's all over that movie. What are you talking about?
Wait, are we getting into Forrest Gump? Because I'm ready for that.
No. We are going to announce spoilers. So if you're playing along on the Facebook page, know that we're about to talk in depth now about Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. You have been warned if you're listening to the podcast later. go away. Come back after you've seen Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, which made... over the weekend, a boatload of money. We were talking about the fact that it earned $181 million domestically. It is up to, according to Gabe's notes here, $748 million
worldwide. I thought I saw that it did it cross? Oh, it hasn't crossed 800 yet.
I guess it's coming up really close to it. I guess it's going
nuts.
To after this weekend.
That's
so
nuts.
Because it opened in other territories and you know, the States almost, we got it like 2 weeks after a lot of other places. Yeah. So... I don't like this movie, and I was really disappointed in it, and I know that Jake says the more he thinks about it, the more he dislikes it, but I don't know if he's fallen down as far back as I have, and then Kevin really likes it a lot. So I'm going to start, and let me just talk, because we kind of kept it out of the text chain about what bothered us about the movie, or what we liked
it. Well, because it got pretty heated in the text chain.
Sean hated the movie so much that he actually moved out of his house because he didn't want that J.A. Bayona poster behind him ever again.
Man.
So he's like, you know what? I'm out of here. Oh, my house has been touched by Bayona. Wow. Bayona. I'm out.
So here's my take on Fallen Kingdom. I think with all of these films, every Jurassic title needs a good reason to go back to the island. And here's where I think we're all going to disagree. I think the rescue of Blue is not a good enough reason. It's not a compelling enough reason for these two people who have been through this really traumatic experience.
But was it the rescue of Blue? I mean, that's what got technically Pratt back, but the reason that they were all going back was the rescue of multiple dinosaurs.
For Bryce Dallas Howard's character, yes. I believed Pratt when he was like, no, don't go back, let them die. Yeah. And I know that that's the crux of the movie, is whether the dinosaurs have rights that are afforded to animals. And so maybe that's where I fall. Maybe I'm, like, when we get to the pivotal, should you push the button or not push the button, like, to me it's a no-brainer, you don't push the button. Why would you release these animals into the wild? So the hook to get them to the island... it just didn't work for me. Like, so from that point on, I was kind of out, and I didn't get back into it.
Yeah, that's tough, because, I mean, that's the movie.
Yeah, that's the movie, and I sort of disagreed with that.
Yeah.
And then from that point, the Volcano Island is so hurried, and I know, Kevin, you've seen it a second time, and you'd say that it plays well, but to me it feels like that they are on that island in real time. The people are on that island for about 20 minutes tops. And you're trying to tell me, like, it's so hard to find Blue, he's so elusive, but, like, they can get him in 20 minutes and then get off the island.
I don't think it was 20 minutes. I mean, you have to also understand how long Pratt was probably out when he got tranked. I think it was probably a couple hours, way more than 20 minutes.
You think so?
Okay. Definitely. I mean, I don't think, how long does a tranquilizer knock you out for? I have no idea. I mean, especially a human being shot by one that's intended for a dinosaur. I think it would kill you. I think it would probably kill you. I mean, if we're speaking realistically, sure, but I don't think he was out for 20. I think it was way more than 20 minutes. Okay. So that
scene didn't feel hurried to you. The dinosaur volcano island didn't seem like it was rushed.
That's actually the only part of the movie I liked.
That seems amazing.
Okay. Yeah, if I'm being honest, that to me, like, that felt like a fresh reason to go back to the island, a fresh reason to sort of, honestly, if the entire movie had been a rescue operation to save the dinosaurs from the island, I think I would have been so into it, because up until about the halfway point of that movie, when Kevin and I saw it together, I looked over at Kevin and said, dude, I am surprisingly digging this movie, speaking as a guy who did not like Jurassic World.
Right.
And it wasn't up until, ironically enough, it became what I consider to be a Bayona movie, sort of this haunted house kind of thing that I just checked out, with the mustache-twirling villains and the weirdly underpaying for $4 million for a dinosaur. Just seems awfully low.
Well, but you have to assume that if they get a dinosaur, they're going to spend a lot for, like, cargo and housing and stuff like that, right? Like $4 million is your initial investment, basically.
It still seems low.
But only one of them, you know, they're expensive. The other ones were going for like 30 or 40. I mean, it wasn't just, but the $4 million, I mean, listen, I mean, like, if
do you know what scene? Oh, I'm sorry, Kevin.
But if you're going to get persnickety about the price of a dinosaur, it's like, I didn't look into it that heavily in regards
to,
like...
Do you know what scene strikes me as bad as the...
The tooth.
The tooth. Solo? Well, I don't like the guy collecting the teeth.
They say to
Bryce Dallas Howard and Chris Pratt, they say, as far as everyone else is concerned, you guys died on the island, right? Like, that's the narrative. So kill them right there. Yeah. Like, why do you leave them alive? That is horrible screenwriting. That is such a dumb scene.
I did wonder that myself. I think
that's Scooby-Doo level.
I just don't know that those people were murderers. You could argue that he took out an older guy. I mean, it's still murder, clearly. But you could argue that maybe these people weren't like cold-blooded killers. I don't know.
That's fine.
I don't know. There's something to be said about somebody pulling a trigger and killing somebody. Like, how far would they go for that? And even...
Right.
Even Buffalo Bill, the guy that took the teeth from the dinosaurs.
Ted Levine?
Yeah, he could have killed Chris Pratt, but they said they shot him with a dart. So,
well, and I also sort of think feel that like, scene... Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Don't you sort of feel like just this franchise is becoming the new Fast and Furious, that where just each movie gets so much more over the top and ridiculous? I mean, think about like how far Fast and Furious has come. The first movie was this simple movie about street racing. And this last one had submarines racing cars through the ice, and it's just like when you think about how ridiculous it's become over the course. And I feel like that's sort of what this series has become. This first movie was a very real, grounded look at man's fascination with playing God and whether or not we have the right to bring these animals back when they were wiped off the planet to begin with. Like, it's a really interesting study. And now it's just this really stupid, like, running from a volcano and then going into, like, they go into a house and now they're going to go to Las Vegas and now there are going to be dinosaurs all over. Like, this is not what Michael Crichton had intended and this is not what Spielberg intended.
Let's get to that ending where the dinosaurs are now released. So we're assuming we're setting up Jurassic World 3, which Colin Trevorrow is going to direct. And if you stay through the end credits, you know that pterodactyls basically land on the Eiffel Tower in Vegas. And the T-Rex is yelling at a lion, and Blue is hovering
over
a...
Which was half the trailer. Half the trailer was in the final 60 seconds.
That was kind of puzzling.
The last line of the movie is in the trailer.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Welcome to the Jurassic World. Yeah.
That stuff is weird. Do any of those scenes get you guys excited for what's to come?
I do find it fascinating to think about those... in Lost World, where did they go? Where, I don't remember.
San Diego.
Okay. So the global...
vagina.
Yeah, the global stretch, though, of like kind of what would happen literally becoming Jurassic World is...
But there aren't that many dinosaurs that got out. I mean, what, maybe...
Well, they can breed.
Five of them?
Well, no, there's not five. Did you see all the ones that left?
No, there were like 12 species. 11 or 12 species, and there were various versions of the different species.
Like, we already have enough dino blending as it is. And also, dinosaurs are fine on their own. You don't need to blend dinosaurs together. They're fine on their own.
Hashtag dino blend.
I like this movie. I actually think it was a lot better the second time around. I don't think it's perfect. I think it has problems. And I think that there is some screenwriting issues. I think the two side characters aren't great. But I thought that shot-wise, this thing was unreal.
Yeah.
But I mean, not just the beauty of like the overall landscape, but just the choices of shadows and reflections and just very old school horror techniques that I thought that Bayona kind of sprinkled in there that were, you know, there's a great moment where that little girl, if I remember correctly, little girl's behind the glass towards the end, and the what's it called, the Indoraptor?
Yeah,
like a skull
on her face.
Yeah. Oh, it's such a great moment. Oh, you see the teeth, and like I thought it was an interesting thing because they were the same thing. You know what
I mean?
Right.
Let's get to the cloning in a second because I do want to bring that
real quick. But that's before the reveal, right?
Yeah.
Okay, was it before or after?
It might be right after because the reveal is
so fast.
It's so fast.
The reveal actually hits a bit harder the second time you see it. I think the first time I saw it, I did not like the reveal because it felt like it was just like, hey, here's this, and then they get away with it, and then it's all gone. But once that button question comes into play, knowing the reveal and kind of sinking in a little more, that button moment is much deeper than I initially hit it.
I'm willing to buy that.
But here's my problem, is that maybe that justifies it for the little girl, but both Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard have to understand the repercussions of pressing that button.
But they didn't want to press it. Bryce Dallas Howard closed it.
I know. So they should be getting this girl away.
Well, the button's pressed. There's nothing you can do. I honestly think that moment is very good on second viewing because the right thing to do is open that door. But the problem is the amount of human deaths that could happen because of that, which is where the conflict comes in with what Bryce is dealing with when she closes it. And I thought that was a fascinating thing that the thing that opens it is the same thing as the dinosaurs. It was built by human. It's a clone, whatever you want to call it. But so I think that there was a fascinating depth to that scene that did not calculate with me the first time I saw it. And then it really hit me the second time. I'm not saying this movie's great by any means, but I think there's a lot of great in the film. And I think it's actually a more solid film than people are giving it credit for. It is pretty well
executed.
Andy
Erickson pointed out a really interesting point, and I agree with him, the guy that's watching on Facebook, I think the opening scene ranks among some of my favorite Jurassic Park scenes. That scene in the rain, where they're sneaking in, and the T-Rex is.
Amazing.
I kind of wish that like the poster didn't ruin that scene.
By the way, the poster.
Dude, totally.
So Jake, I thought about Jake the other day about this. Jake, we actually are a little slightly wrong on that. You and I both are. So the poster is the T-Rex going towards the helicopter.
Yeah.
Not the swimming dinosaur.
But that shot was in a trailer or a TV spot because I had seen that shot too.
Right, but
where the Mosasaurus comes out of the.
But you and I were discussing the poster ruining it.
But I'm just saying, like, I wish that like I did that like that entire scene, like if I'm the marketing, like leave that entire scene out, like that.
It was
scene
a cool
was great.
That opening scene's amazing. See, like I think this film is actually very well done. And I think the opening scene's amazing. The whole first act with the volcanic eruption, the one shot in the gyrosphere, all that was amazing. I think the second, then you have the boat scene, which is the fully animatronic moments, which were phenomenal. And then you have the third part of the film, which is the Haunted Mansion part, which arguably may or may not be as good as the beginning, but there is a lot to be said about what's going on in the shot choices in that third act. And it is fascinating to watch Bayona kind of trickle in his horror homages in a major film like this. And I think the second viewing is it's very rewarding, in my opinion.
The most beautiful shot takes place in a really laughable scene. The most beautiful shot takes place in the cage where the Indoraptor's pretending to be knocked out so that the guy can go in and take the tooth.
Yeah.
Oh, but it's so obvious.
What is the shot? What shot?
It's like it's backlit. It backlights the Indoraptor from behind because she's like laying on the floor of the cage and it's white and the guy's like in silhouette stepping over her. Kind of. It's a beautiful shot.
I don't remember that.
See, I would argue.
I like the T-Rex roaring with the. I know it's used in every poster and trailer, but the T-Rex roaring with the volcano erupting by the T-Rex. Yeah. I decided to do
that shot. And then the shot when the Indoraptor first comes out and the guy goes over to the Indoraptor with the electricity thing and it's just the shadow on the wall of the Indoraptor's face as every time it gets hit, it shadows. And then there's the best shot in the film besides the one Jake's referring to is the shot when we first get a wide angle of Chris Pratt and Blue and there's this like gorgeous rainbow lens flare that sits on top of Pratt's face, which I obviously was not planned. It couldn't have been. And they decided to keep it in there. And it's such a great shot. And I think there's just something. It's a really interesting film, and I definitely have problems with it for sure. But I think it's a much better film than everybody's giving it credit for.
All right, I want to get to an unpopular opinion for this week's conversation because it was part of our text chain and we had some fun with it. We decided to rank the second best Jurassic film of all time. Collectively recognizing that Jurassic Park is Jurassic Park, right? And then it's everything that comes after it. Kevin, go first.
This one. Oof. But I haven't seen Lost World in 3 in 10 years. So, this is coming from an opinion of I didn't love Lost World when I first saw it. I don't even think Spielberg loves Lost World. 3 was a very... I didn't thought 3 was bad. Jurassic World I did not particularly like, so people listening right now, if you disagree with my opinion on Fallen Kingdom, I did not like Jurassic World. So I thought this one was a major, major, major step up from Colin Trevorrow's film. Again, having not seen Lost World in a long time, I don't remember my memory of that film being a great experience. I remember...
It has a great sequence in it. It has one great sequence. And then Spielberg basically admitted that...
great sequences.
I know that Jake's going to pick this. So I'm going to knock it a little bit. I mean, Spielberg rushed the San Diego stuff because that was supposed to be the story for part 3. And then he kind of realized, I'm not going to... Like, bringing the dinosaurs to the mainland in the planned trilogy of Jurassic Park was going to be... what part 3 was, and then Spielberg realized, well, I'm probably not going to get a chance to direct this third one, and I really want to bring the dinosaurs to the mainland. So, I mean, I think that's how it happened. That's the story as I know it. I don't know if that's 100% true.
I read that he wanted to do it because there was another old dinosaur film called The Lost World in which the dinosaur goes to the mainland. I think it goes to London, maybe? And that he was doing it as a tribute to that.
Okay, so is your pick Lost World?
Yes, my pick's Lost World, and I did rewatch all of the Jurassic movies before we went to Hawaii for the junket, so they're all pretty fresh in my mind. I just think that like beyond Park, they all have issues, they all have problems. Yeah. I think Lost World has the least problems, and then it's not going to be Park, and none of them ever are. But Lost World has some great Spielberg moments where you go. That's the trailer hanging off the cliff. Julianne Moore falling, hitting the glass.
Yeah, that's a great shot.
Yeah, the shot of them running through. And this was a time where velociraptors were so scary and not the pet dog, where they were like running through the tall grass. And you see not the raptors, but like the parting of the grass and the raptors are close. I mean, the raptors used to be scary.
I hate that about Fallen Kingdom is that the raptors aren't scary anymore.
It's a dog. It's a dog. Yeah. It listens to
it. The raptors weren't scary in Jurassic World either. Remember, wasn't Chris Pratt riding one of them?
The Jurassic, come on. Jurassic World ruined the
raptors. Know me. You know me.
You know me. Ruined the once the raptors, they're jumping the shark was riding alongside.
But you like Jurassic World, Sean.
My choice for the best Jurassic movie not named Jurassic Park is Jurassic World. To me, Jurassic World is the best one that they've done since then. And it's actually great.
It goes against what you just said.
It's actually
my least favorite.
It's the worst one.
No, it's really good.
I take three over
I do too.
No, and I'll tell you why.
It's not good.
The main reason is because they have a legit reason for being on the island. They've successfully created the theme park that Hammond always wanted to do. And it's been chugging along nicely. It's a Disney-esque successful theme park. People, like, millions of people are coming to it. The only place where they screwed it up is that they decided to make it more exciting, they blended the genes together to create this Indominus Rex.
Dude, and then Jurassic World is the TV dinner of Jurassic movies. It's a reheated replication of something that you love. That's why I take 3 over World, because yes, 3 not a great reason to go back to the park, but at least it took chances and it feels like a bad but new Jurassic Park movie. There were moments where like they were at least going for something. They at least tried to do something as opposed to Jurassic World is just like, remember when.
Hold on.
But Fallen Kingdom is a great example of taking what Spielberg did and flipping it and not just copying it and or reheating it, as Jake said. The idea of the human element of the story being a little more prominent than the dinosaurs, but both kind of equal playing fields. As Bayona said in interviews, that like even the object in the mirror and the is closer than they appear. Instead of the T-Rex, you see Chris Pratt or whatever. I thought it was fascinating.
Sell me Jurassic World.
It's its own thing. It doesn't try desperately to connect to the original ones by including a Jeff Goldblum or a Sam Neill. It's truly its own standalone thing with new characters that they hope you invest in. And for a lot of people, they did. I actually think Fallen Kingdom might have been a better story if they didn't try and force Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard back into it. If it were new people who just went back to the island on a conservation mission to rescue these dinosaurs and got caught up in a volcano mission, maybe I would have been like, oh, I'm totally on board. But every sequel since tries to cram in references and people that you know. So even when they do the objects in mirror in Fallen Kingdom, it's like, oh, yeah, again, of course. No, another reference different. To Jurassic Park.
I thought it was that. I think the Chris Pratt storyline of the and the reason they go back to the park in Fallen Kingdom is actually very good. And I think anybody, in my opinion, who everybody understands the idea of animals and just the selflessness of them and the innocence of them. And it was a perfect reason for them to return. I can't think of a better reason for Pratt to go back there and get Blue than them all dying.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think you don't need Pratt. I think you don't need that character.
How do you get Blue?
Get someone else.
No one else can get Blue. Remember they even say in the movie that Blue can smell even 1 mile away. Only Pratt
make another one. Make another one. You're just making them in lamps anyway. Make another one. Who cares? Same thing with the girl. Once I found out that girl was a clone, I never understood why these people were risking their lives to save her. So make another girl.
I thought the clone thing was funny, once I figured out
that the two kids in Jurassic World were brats, I didn't care about them. I just wanted them to be
eaten. All right, we have to move on. Let us know on Real Blend.
Jurassic World is not good, man.
It's great. It's actually great.
No, Fallen Kingdom is
I think what we're the fact that, like, what we should be arguing about is not what the second best Jurassic Park movie is, but what the worst is, because that's where we all...
The worst is World.
It's 3.
No, World. I think it's 3.
No, I think it's 3. All right, this week's game is hashtag Arnold Blend, and we have 2 components of it, so we have to get going, because
this was fun. It took me a second to stop and think.
All right, we're going to pick his best performance, and we're going to pick his best line. Gabe, what should we do? 3 performances first, and then 3 lines, or 3 performances first. All right, Jake, I've been told that you get to go first. Ooh. Best Arnold Schwarzenegger performance.
Are we guessing or no?
Oh, yes. Gabe told us we all have different choices.
We do. Wow, we all have different.
We all have different choices. Different choices for the movie and different choices for the lines, I believe.
That means
Gabe, is that correct? Gosh. All right, he's sort of saying.
Hold on a second. If we have all different choices for his best performance, that means you two are wrong. Right?
I guess. Probably. Okay, all right, probably. Cool. Jake, I'm going to guess that Jake says his best performance...
I'm hiding my face so you can't see my...
...is...
reaction.
I'll say Terminator.
Which one?
2. T2.
I'm going to guess Jake says... Arnold's best performance is Junior.
I actually picked the very first Terminator.
Oh!
I just think that's
close.
That role, he disappears. I don't see Arnold when I see that part. I just think when he's a villain, there's just a ruthlessness. There's no pun intended. There's a machine quality to him. As much as I, even though I think Terminator 2 is a better movie, unfortunately, by that point, Arnold is so big, I kind of start to see Arnold more so than I see the character. First movie, I just think I don't see Arnold. I just see this almost like the shark in Jaws. I just see this unrelenting, nonstop killing machine that has this mission and is going to do whatever it takes to complete the mission. It's actually, I feel like, kind of an underrated performance, and I'd argue borderline terrifying when you think of just how diligent, how it's just, it's really, really a scary performance, and it's one of the few times where I love Arnold. He's not what I would call an amazing actor, but it's one of the few moments where I'd pause and go like, damn, dude, like, well done. That's a great performance.
Okay, Kevin is up, and we get to pick, and I'm absolutely guessing T2 again.
Yeah, I would guess T2.
You know what's interesting? So it is T2. What's fascinating about what Jake just said is I completely agree, but then I also completely disagree with everything you just said, which is weird, because I agree that's probably the least Arnold-esque performance because of how monstrous the character is, how machine-like the character is, which is an interesting thing to think about.
Early Arnold looks like he's made of clay, but he's not quite finished yet.
He kind of looks like the Arnold that they recreated. Yeah, in the later sequels.
Right. Like, later he becomes more chiseled. Yeah. But, like, in Terminator, he looks like this mold of monstrous clay that's coming out.
What's funny about that is that's kind of how I feel about T2 when John Connor's, like, poking his face. And he's, like, picking the bullets out of, like, I always love that, like, when he, like, goes, like, he's, like, it's like he's, like, cool, man. I always love that. But, what Jake just said is fascinating to me because I agree that that's probably the least Arnold-esque performance. But then the reason I disagree with what you said is because I think T2 is the best performance of his career because it's the struggle of becoming human and finding human emotion within a machine. And I think the beauty of that performance is we know this person, this thing is not a human being. And Arnold's restraint of allowing some of that caring element to come through while he's protecting John Connor, but he never fully becomes human. And to find that gray area where it's never obvious that he's becoming human is, to me, the art of that performance. And I think it's fascinating to think about. I never thought about it that deeply until Jake said what he just said about Terminator 1 in regards to that character being the least Arnold-esque and machine-like as possible. And now that I'm looking at Terminator 2, I'm like, damn, like, that's kind of crazy that he found this strange gray area and was able to peek through with a bit of humanity. And I think the moment that I think everybody, it hits you, is the I know now why you cry moment. And he's just like, it's so beautiful. And then he puts his thumb up and there's just every time I watch that movie, I genuinely hope it's somehow going to change. And then, like, John's gonna, like, bring him back up before he goes into the molten steel. And I'm like, I just don't want him to go. And it's, like, a horrifying thing. And he puts the thumb up, and I felt so bad. And just when he's getting destroyed by Robert Patrick's character. And it's a great performance by every standard. And the best scene in Terminator 2, James Cameron cut out. And it's in the special edition. Yeah, Jake's doing the smile. They brought it back a little bit in Genesis, which was poorly. You know what's funny about that? As I didn't like it in Genesis, but it allowed me to bring it up when I interviewed him for it. I was like, I get to talk to him about the smile scene. It was like my favorite moment ever, like having him, like, and he did it in the interview. I was like, oh my God. But like the that scene, if people aren't aware of it, John Connor's teaching him how to be more human. This is right after the Hasta La Vista moment, as they're driving to that like food area, and there's those kids playing with the guns, and like John Connor's kind of having that like that moment where he's like the world's gonna end kind of thing, and he teaches him how to smile. And like Arnold, as Jake was saying, he's so machine like but to see this machine like open his mouth and start to grittily smile, it's so good. And it's honestly to me that I wish that scene was still in the film, and I understand why Cameron cut it because of pacing, but it's interesting. So hands down his best performance, but interestingly enough, what Jake just said kind of made me think even deeper about Terminator 2. Terminator 2 is the reason why I do what I do today. So like, that movie changed my life. So
I did not pick a Terminator movie, so you guys get to guess.
Ooh.
You went...
I say True Lies.
True Lies is so good, man. Ooh. You know what, Jake? I'm just trying to think of, like, where he's at. Wow. I don't know. Where
Dude, there are, like, four movies to choose
from. No, there's a... no, but... There was
we can scratch off Jingle All the Way.
You didn't go with Predator. I mean, True Lies is probably the... His yeah probably I'll go with I agree with Jake True Lies.
I picked True Lies.
Hey
yeah it makes sense. Yeah.
True Lies is awesome.
It is a great movie.
It's so awesome. But what the thing about True Lies is that it's that it takes everything that you love about Arnold and it asks him to just do more. Like in all of those movies like Commando and Predator, like he's the badass unstoppable machine, you know, that has to fight against an alien or, you know, take down bad guys who are going after his daughter. And the whole characteristic of the character is just that he's an incredibly strong guy who can't be stopped. But in True Lies, it gives him new wrinkles to play with. Like, the whole subplot about it is his wife cheating on him.
Yeah.
Lets him play... It's his Bond movie, but it's also this great, you know, like, character-driven hook to a normal Arnold action movie. And I mean, it's weird to say that about a film that ends the way it does... With him in the cockpit, you know, piloting the jet.
You're fired.
but it just, it gives him, I think, more than anyone else did beforehand in movies like Running Man or, you know, any of the Conan films.
Running Man's a movie that should be remade because that's a great
I like story.
Yes, it's a tremendous story. Yes,
because the
really
guy
does
in half said he had to split. Yeah. Oh,
even
God.
Total Recall, you know, is kind of like a straightforward Arnold movie. Yeah. But, like, I think True Lies just gives him, I think True Lies Cameron respected him as an actor and said, I'm going to give you things to play with that I don't think other people give to you because they don't think you can handle it, and showed that he could actually handle it.
The scene with Arnold and Bill Paxton is arguably one of the funniest and like most geniusly written scenes. Just like, I love moments like that because like, it's almost like the audience has a secret window into this world that the other character doesn't know about. I love little things like that because like,
yeah.
We don't, like, Bill doesn't know that we know that Arnold knows that he's the one, like, with his wife. And it's like this, like, every line that comes out of Bill Paxton's mouth in that scene hits you so much harder because you know that Arnold knows what's going on.
But you know what? If Arnold's not good, then True Lies is only half as good of a movie.
Oh, he's amazing.
Right? Like, if Van Damme is in it.
But it also seems like he's having fun, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, And I'm not saying what he doesn't have fun in other movies, but it seems like he is actively enjoying being in True Lies.
It was a little, it's a looser role for him. Like it was, it's like, he's just kind of, he's not, you're right. He's not being the typical Arnold, but
has pretty good comedic timing.
Great comedic timing.
You gotta give it to him.
Kim and Cameron worked great together, man. Like they were so, I mean, that was a great team. And like, that was, I think Cameron wrote that script. I mean, that was like when Cameron was writing really good scripts. I think he wrote that script. But, yeah. So, all right.
That version of Cameron, because I want that. Okay, let's go through our one-liners with quick explanations as to why we chose them, because we're running out of show. Jake.
Yeah. I chose I'll Be Back. There's just, I mean, when it comes to an impact on pop culture, I mean, you say that line. I'm not saying they didn't have, like, other great one-liners, but you could probably say quote a few, and people won't know what you're talking about. I'll Be Back is maybe the most parodied movie line in history.
Yeah.
And when you think about the impact, the ripples that still has today, kids who were born years after that movie came out know what I'll Be Back is. And I'm sorry, like, to me, there's no other choice other than that one.
You also have to say it like him every time you say it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You can't knock. Right. Kevin, what'd you pick?
Yeah, it's a fascinating discussion because... Yeah, if you look at it from the impact of culture and what a different cinema, then Jake's 100% right. When I think of best Arnold one-liner, my opinion on it is it comes down to, does it strike that perfect tone of cheesy and just awesome, but also it just works. And again, another window into the world of like, we know something the other characters don't. And I think, I mean, I mentioned this in the show last week, but I think the Commando Dead Tired line is the best line because... Not only is it perfectly written, but it's so well executed. And
Kevin, explain it for people that don't know what that line is. Well, explain it in context.
It just the deadpan delivery of that line. No pun intended. Like, so Arnold's on a plane with a guy who's accompanying him to go murder somebody, or they're going to kill Arnold's daughter. And the guy is, like, sitting next to him, and he's being rude to Arnold the whole time, and literally breaks his neck, like, knocks him out, breaks his neck, kills this guy with no feeling whatsoever. Just, I mean, the whole part of that movie is just him to get back to his daughter. That's all he cares about. He jumps out of a freaking plane as it's taking off. I mean, it's crazy. But here's the thing. So not only does he kill the guy, but he politely says to the stewardess, excuse me, don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired. And, like, the guy, like, he has his hat over his...
I'm not sure I get it. Can you really...
No, Jake, we're running out of show. Yeah.
Explain
no,
it.
Jake, stop.
In all seriousness... But wait. Not only that, doesn't he... You know, he asks the stewardess for a pillow and a blanket, doesn't he? And then he tucks the guy in, right? I think he, like, literally tucks the guy in to go to bed. Right. And he puts his hat over his face. Like, he treats him like he's a little baby. He's, like, taking care of this guy that he's killed. And then he tells the stewardess to don't disturb him because he's dead tired. And she thinks, oh, it's because he's tired. I'll leave him alone. You know, people fall asleep on planes all the time. That guy is dead. And, like, he just told the stewardess that he's... I mean, it's...
I'm not getting it.
You guys can make fun of me.
Kevin, start back at the top.
You guys can make fun of me, but that
is line, the guy alive?
That line deserves to be on the AFI top 100 lines of all time.
Oh.
It is a genius line of dialogue.
I stayed in Commando because it's so great.
I know.
Arnold in Commando doesn't look like a human
being. It's the
best. He looks like he's literally shaped from metal.
How great is the beginning when he's feeding deer with who's the daughter?
Alyssa Milano.
Yeah.
Alyssa Milano.
Like, and there's, like, this horribly cheesy scene, and, like, he thinks, like, someone's sneaking up on him, and the music just turns into, like, this, like, family thing, and he grabs her, and he's like, oh! Like, and they go off on, like, this beautiful, like, picnic, and, like, they're feeding deer, and then I think he kills 120 people in that film. I think that's his biggest body count. There was
a
website.
There's a website that counts it, right? The line I chose is when he throws a pipe through the chest of the guy he's fighting at the end of the movie,
Bennett.
And it goes so far through Bennett that it punctures a tank behind him.
Yeah.
And steam comes out through the pipe. And this, again, ticks the boxes. Like, Jake picked an iconic one, and he's right. But, like, Kevin and I both went for, like, just really cheesy over-the-top ones. Where he says, let off some steam, Bennett.
I'm sorry, you're going to have to explain it to me.
Let's break down. Here's the thing
is coming out of him, Jake.
So is he dead? Is he dead tired?
Well, I don't know if that's
the... He's also an angry guy, so the steam element being let off, he needs to relax.
He needs to relax.
If you think about these lines, they're the layers to them.
I'm
not even joking, and I know Jake thinks I'm joking.
Yeah,
I am.
No, trust me.
I'm
very aware that you're not joking.
There is a deepness to those lines
that people
look at them and they laugh because they're goofy. But if you think about the delivery on those lines, it's
stick
great.
Around is another one I almost
stick
went
around.
I can't tell if I'm being trolled right now.
You're not.
Nobody can
show.
Nobody can pull those lines off except for him.
It's true.
Other
people have tried, and it doesn't work.
He literally jokes about killing a guy and says, stick around, while he's stuck to a board with a knife through his chest, okay? I mean, there is something to be said about, like, how brilliant that is, if you think about it.
The audience pick for his best film was Total Recall. People who played at home using Arnold Blend...
What?
Went with Total Recall as the choice, yes. And then Terminator T2. And Gabe is trolling us when he tells me that Jingle All the Way was tied for second.
I love Jingle All the Way. Put the cookie down. I love Jingle All the Way, man. It's one of his best movies. Actually, Jingle All the Way is actually...
Actually, I love Jingle All the Way.
Another realm of the True Lies type of Arnold. It's a different, looser...
I'm sorry, Kindergarten Cop didn't get any love.
Oh, God.
Kindergarten Cop is great.
So great. How horrifying is that scene in Kindergarten Cop when he falls asleep at the desk and then he has that dream where the villain comes to the window
in
the rain?
Yeah. Yep.
That scared really me so. And then how violent is that ending in the shower? Like that, and then the mom comes in with the gun. It's like pretty horrifying film. Yeah, honestly,
it's not a kid movie. Okay, and I'll be back. Was a clear cut winner for one liner. So Jake wins. Although I think Kevin and our description were worthy, definitely worthy. I think we changed some people's minds.
I think so too.
And we touched some hearts at the same time.
I think we touched some hearts. Yes. Your homework for next week. We are going to play. Love when you guys perk up. Listen, to what it's going to be hashtag Burton Blend, where we will discuss the films of Tim Burton. Please start weighing in now using social media. We can be found at Real Blend, RealBlend. I will remind you guys, if you go over to iTunes or Spotify and all those different places and leave us a star rating and an audience review, we will try to read them at the top of the show. And thank you very much to all four people who left us reviews this week. Jake, where can people find you on social media?
At Jake's Takes.
Yes. Kevin, where can we find you on social media?
Jesus Christ.
At Dunkirk. Shot with IMAX film cameras.
That's my Twitter handle.
I'm at Sean_O'Connell. We will be back next week where we will tease.
I love the person who doesn't reveal his Twitter handle every week has more Twitter followers than the people they shout out their Twitter handle every week.
Yes, than all of us combined.
That helps me sleep at night.
Ant-Man and the Wasp. Tim Burton blend, and Jake is going to come up with a new news song. So thank you very much for tuning in on the Facebook page, and we will talk to you guys next week.
Dunkirk.
Yos.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.